Welcome to NucleCast, the official podcast of the NY Deterrence Center. Our host is Dr. Adam Laufer, co-founder and vice president for research at the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. The NY Deterrence Center is a 501c3 organization ensuring a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrent and its ongoing modernization. Thank you for listening and welcome to the show. The views of the host and the guests are their own.
Welcome back to another episode of NucleCast. Of course, I'm Adam Lowther, and this is part two of our conversation with the former Global Strike Commander, General Jim Kowalski. And we were talking in the first episode about the rationale for the stand-up of Global Strike Command and sort of what led to it. And then I took a few unexpected turns with some questions, and we ran out of time. And so we decided we'd come back for this second episode, and we're going to pick up with the stand-up of the command in 2009. So with that, boss, I'll turn it over to you.
Okay, great. So the command, we had that group of about 50 people out in out at Bowling Air Force Base. There was only one person assigned to the command, and it was me, and that's as a provisional command. So what we needed to do was we needed to get the basing resolved. That basing announcement was the most made in June of 2009. We had worked with the chief's office to schedule the activation ceremony. And I'm sure there's folks in the audience that have had to deal with trying to get on the chief of staff of the Air Force's schedule. And we were able to work that in. Coincidentally, it ended up being 7 August, which is the date right in between the Hiroshima and the Nagasaki, the first uses of nuclear weapons. That was not intentional. There were some in the arms control community that accused us of making a statement, but we weren't smart enough to make a statement either way. We just wanted to get the daggone command activated and get on with our business. We had done the program, the PAD document. We had filled out what we called the P plan, the programming plan that had 700 items in it. So we really needed to get this command activated. We needed to get rolling on those 700 items. We had already looked toward the future of, okay, well, when, as you stand up a command and you man the headquarters, we had already been through the process of where were we going to put it? How are we going to locate offices? I mean, there's a whole lot of, where do you get desks, pens, pencils? There's a lot of detail that goes into, just getting that stuff up and running. Make sure you got the comm pieces right so you can communicate with folks internally within the command, and then to the folks in the command that are external. And then when would we take, when would we get operational control of the numbered air forces and then have the authorities to do the directive activities there and let them report through Air Force Global Strike Command, as opposed to 8th Air Force going through Air Combat Command and 20th Air Force going through Air Force Space Command. Go ahead.
Was there any contemplation of hosting the command anywhere other than Barksdale, or was that sort of an immediate given?
Well, that's where the three-star billet was coming from. Okay, so it was going to be the 8th Air Force Commander's billet was the billet, the three-star billet that was going to be used. You know, the number of three stars and four stars are set by Congress. But we did have to go through the basing process. And, one of the things that we knew early on is we wanted to have the command on a base that had Air Force nuclear operations, fielded forces. So that's either ICBMs or B-52s, because the command was set up with just the B-52s, not the B-1s. And, we can have some discussion about that, but that's that's how the command was ended up being structured and how the decisions were made. So when you add that in, then you go through a basing process. So you look at all the bases that had those forces, and that's an external process. So we, the Air Force, and particularly the folks that were working on the team, didn't really have anything, any role in that process other than to advise them if they asked us some questions. They went through their initial process. At some point in that process, Omaha, Nebraska had been added to the list of bases to look at. Omaha's and it's an awesome city. I ended up, my final command tour as a deputy commander was in Omaha, and frankly, one of the nicest places we've ever lived. But they did not have an operational unit there. So when you look at all the scoring criteria, and I don't recall all of it was, but it's, I think it's what you'd reasonably expect. You know, what's the size of the population? What's the available housing? What's the available labor pool to draw from to fill different positions? I think when you went through the scoring, Omaha clearly came out on top. Number two was Barksdale because of the large community here at Shreveport, Bossier City. But at the end of the day, Omaha probably should not have been in the mix to begin with. And that caused some hard feelings with the civic leaders up in Omaha, which was unfortunate. But, you know, I think where we ended up with the command was the right choice, and a choice that was made truly independent of any other influences.
Okay. Okay, so go ahead with the I digress more, there for a second.
Probably more than you wanted to know about that process. But it really, the final decision wasn't made till June. So we were on the calendar to activate this command in August. We had expected to be moving people in April or May. So the Omaha added to the process, and then going through having to explain why it wasn't selected actually delayed us about 2 months. And I could whine about the $25,000 in damage done to my household goods as I tried to move at DC with about 2 weeks notice, but you end up with a little PTSD on that one. But a lot of folks had that problem where, the decision, the Air Force said, okay, the base is Barksdale. And then they had to go through that whole process from April. So what we thought was going to happen in May, didn't happen until you got back into mid-June. And by the time you get the orders and everything, we had people who were coming to us from, Air Command and Staff, Air War College. And of course, those are moves that normally happen around May. So everybody's sort of sitting on their hands, can't go anywhere, but they can't stay there. So yeah, it was a little bit of turmoil for that initial group, the plank holders that showed up to the command, because we needed those folks to help start everything, to include, although we had done some planning of the activation, that was one of the first big things we had to do is figure out, okay, well, we don't have a protocol shop. We don't have this. We don't have that. The other thing. So, geez, how the heck do you do an activation of a command? So,
right.
Fortunately, we'd already had a lot of contacts, both in Air Force Base Command and Air Combat Command. Obviously, we'd been working closely with the Air Staff, mm-hmm. So we were able to pull all that together. It wasn't a big challenge, but it did. A lot of people were running around with their hair on fire. So we get through the activation ceremony. We begin standing up the command. Lieutenant General Klotz is the first commander. He was the assistant vice chief of staff of the Air Force. He had been in a number of fairly high positions in the Air Force. He had been the acting commander of Air Force Space Command. He had been the 20th Air Force commander, so he had deep nuclear background and expertise. you know, Rhodes Scholar out of the Air Force Academy. He's written a number of things. I learned a lot from working with General Klotz, and he really did a good job of understanding some of the things that were most important to sort of righting the ship for the Air Force nuclear enterprise. And I'll get to those here in a little bit, but let me walk through a timeline first, and then I'll just take it sort of topic by topic. So, you know, we get to the activation ceremony in August. And then we begin, one of the big things we have to do is we got to get the people in. We got to choose people. We got to get them. We got to get them in seats. We got to find out where their seats are. For a while there, we were scattered in a number of different temporary locations around base as we moved into the 8th Air Force headquarters. And as 8th Air Force, also had to move too. Right. And they actually moved off base to a building called the Cyber Innovation Center. Yeah. And, everybody had to settle into those routines. One of the big advantages we had as we came into this, although we were a 3-star level command, which in turn affects the level of every person in it. So if you have a 4-star command, a division chief can be a GS-15 or a 06. If you have a 3-star command, that same division chief is a GS-14 or a lieutenant colonel. Right. So when you go to meetings with other across commands, you've got the lieutenant colonel in the room with the colonel or the GS-14 in the room with the GS-15. So there's sort of a disparity there at the beginning that was a constant sand in the wheels as, you know, decisions would have to be elevated because at a lot of these working group levels, we weren't getting much traction. Yeah. There was a lot of sense, particularly with some of the other commands and across the Air Force that, well, this is standing up Global Strike Command's a temporary thing. Once everything gets back on track, you know, we'll just get this numbered Air Force back or,
So there wasn't a perception that Global Strike was going to be the home for the nuclear forces. ACC or Space Force thought they might get the 20th or 8th.
I don't think the Space Force had the feeling they were going to get the ICBMs back. But I did get a clear impression. It wasn't just Air Combat Command. I mean, at the lower general officer and senior colonel rank as well. Once we get this fixed, we'll get realigned here and we'll get all of the combat power back in Air Combat Command. And that was sort of a drag on it too, because there was always in the background at all of these working levels, this sense of, well, we'll see how long this lasts. I get it. I was in the Air Force a long time. You see big changes come and you go, well, you know, let's not rush into this because, you know, we're coming up to election. Things could change. No telling what's really going to happen.
Right.
So,
yeah.
And part of that is getting off the subject of this a little bit, but part of that is changing cultures. And that was one of the big challenges that General Klotz tackled was how do you change the culture of 20th Air Force and 8th Air Force and all of those units underneath them? And how do you create a culture within this new headquarters? What does that culture look like? And of course, you know, culture is behavior over time. So now you have to figure out what are the behaviors that we want to see? What are the incentives that we're going to use to achieve those behaviors? What are the metrics that we're going to measure all this with? So a lot of that, was deeply thought about at early on by the leadership. So as a lot of this was hiring, and fortunately we had the NSPS, the National Security Personnel System, that had just gone into effect a few years before, and it gave us a window to really on the civilian side be very proactive and move very quickly to fill a lot of the civilian positions. And we were very successful at that. The only challenge that we then had was that in October of 2009, the NSPS was terminated. Mm-hmm. And the old system of doing civil service personnel processes was reestablished, and all of the hiring just ground to a halt of getting civilians in. And where under the NSPS, you didn't have the GS levels, you had bands. So we didn't have the restriction of, well, 15 versus a 14 versus a 13, et cetera. We could just hire somebody into a band that was appropriate for the job. And so we were able to get a hold of a good group of solid folks. And some of them are still at the headquarters and now, and they've moved up to, you know, near SES positions. So anyway, that was one of the first challenges we faced was the NSPS termination. It was a DOD efficiency effort. So DOD, and it started there, sort of as you got into 2010, there was the discussion about this DOD efficiency effort. And, you know, DOD wide, they out of headquarters, you know, they were called it overhead. They were looking to save $100 billion over 5 years. Well, that turns into bills on the services, and then a bill on the services turns into a bill for Air Force Global Strike Command. So there we were at about 30% manned, and we're getting bills. Bills for dollar, you know, turn money back in, find efficiencies. Like, man, we're too busy. We were directed to stand this up as a lean command. So we were hoping we would get a little bit of credit there. I don't think we got much. So we were with all the other players, trying to figure out how to implement that. But part of that is just being a grown up in a big bureaucracy like the Air Force. On 1 September, of 2009, we took operational control of the ICBMs in 20th Air Force, and then went through the new year. And on 1 February of 2010, we took operational control of 8th Air Force, and we got the authorities and all the reporting then from 8th Air Force then went through the command. I think we talked about the Air Force efficiency thing. A lot of this time now is spent with General Klotz going out to the units and carrying his message of what this new command is about. So we had we had our mission statement. We had his list of things that he was going to accomplish, what the goals were going to do. He was sitting down with the enlisted folks. He was sitting down with the junior officers. He was sitting down with the senior staff at each of the wings. And that was a big part of, you know, those kind of engagements were a big part of what's going on. You know, I knew that Air Combat Command commander with all of his bases didn't really have the opportunity to have that kind of MAGCOM commander presence out there in the field. We were between General Klotz during his tenure and I during my tenure, we were probably visiting each wing twice a year because we were right sized to do that. So we could try to let people know what the message. The other thing that was important during this period is we didn't really change our messages very much. So we were trying to, you know, it's really hard to change the culture of organizations. It's hard to get that new traction. But one way that you do that is you just be consistent with the messages for as long as possible, because you'll lose their interest if you start, okay, well, we've got a new way to explain the three things that's most important. Well, we added a thing. So now there's four things that's most important. So we didn't do any of that. You know, there was a lot of thought that went into the mission statement that we had under General Klotz, and I just carried that mission statement forward.
This episode of NucleCast is brought to you by the AMLA Deterrence Center, whose mission is to educate Americans about the nuclear enterprise and strategic deterrence. Would you say that the effort to reemphasize sort of nuclear competencies and that, I wouldn't necessarily say the SAC culture, but, you know, some of the strengths, at least, of the SAC culture. Was that a challenge, or, you know, was there a lot of sort of amongst airmen, you know, hey, you know, we'll see how this thing turns out? Or were people like, okay, great, we're now, you know, we're now nuclear focused again? Yeah. I mean, how was that? How did that work? I mean, we, you know, 2014 and, you know, subsequent to that, you know, we were still working on this, but sort of in those early days, what did that look like?
Well, it wasn't, I don't think there was a whole lot of, I mean, obviously there were a lot of retired folks that were chiming in with, yeah, okay, let's get the SAC culture back. And I spent my first part of my career in Strategic Air Command, and I was very proud of that. But it's a different world in 2008, 2009, 2010 than it was, you know, in the heyday of, you know, deterrence 1.0 with the Soviet sure. Union. So the message really was a little bit different. You know, it was a little bit more balanced. And it was a real emphasis on the special trust and responsibility of nuclear weapons. So it's hard to go out there and be too much of a nuclear warrior when the president of the United States is talking about the eventual retirement of all nuclear weapons. And that's not a criticism. I mean, you know, for the time, you know, he also said, and I think we used some of the other phrases he had in his speech, you know, that nuclear speech that he had very early in his tenure. But we also said, you know, they may not go away in my lifetime, you know, and we are going to keep them. And so we really did. We emphasized a safe, secure, and effective list. You know, yeah. We sort of went back to an older way of saying it, and really emphasized special trust and responsibility. And I've got the you know, to support the president commanders. I mean, these are the president's weapons. We are the president's nuclear force. He is the eventual commander of us. You know, we're not getting chopped, you know, to go out and do this on behalf of, you know, just some random combatant commander. We're doing it directly for the president through, U.S. Strategic Command. So, and some of this really had to be explained to folks. Also to remember, we'd been a decade in the global war on terror. So particularly those forces that on the ICBM community were getting rotated out to the theaters, for example, EOD folks going out to the theater. And then on the bomber side, you know, I actually had aviation units deploying out to the theater. So their focus had drifted more than the focus of the ICBM community.
I remember missileers, you know, hopping at the opportunity because they, you know, they wanted to go to Iraq or Afghanistan. So they would go and become a, you know, a convoy. You're an ICBM officer and you're a convoy commander, you know, driving around Iraq. Yeah. I mean, but that's what you did because that was, you know, really critical to your, you know, to your career progression. And so you did what you had to do.
Yeah. And a little off topic, but, and that's one of the things that we tackled early on was what we found is that in all the promotion systems, you know, the Air Force was rewarding deployments in the war on terror. So if you were, you know, pulling duty in the missile field at minus 20 degrees, going out to, you know, check an alarm at an ICBM site, you got no credit. You know, that was not considered hard enough duty. So we had worked hard to get in some deployed in place is the terminology we're using, get deployed in place credit so that, you know, particularly our enlisted folks, you know, weren't getting left behind because they were doing really hard work and they needed to be recognized for that.
Sure.
So anyway, we get into 2011. Now we're struggling to get the civilian personnel we need, and it required numerous engagements to get, you know, like personally going down to San Antonio to the personnel center and engaging with how people were hired, because they have a process in place, and that process, you know, Air Force is a big bureaucracy, and the processes that work great day to day, and they work great day to day for years, don't work very well to meet the needs of a new major command, the first major command to stand up in about 20 years, because nobody knows how to do it differently than they've been doing. So, you know, you're trying to get new authorities, you're trying to get senior leader interest within those organizations. You're trying to build the relationships with the people that are doing the work that said, yeah, I know you try to treat everybody the same, but could you give us a little love here?
Sure.
So we had some success there. We were building up. I think by the time we got toward the end of 2010, so it'd been, you know, maybe a year and a half of being in this, we were at about 66% manned between civilians and active duty and the rest. But we were still, not there. We still had this other third that had to come in. And as we got further downstream, we were going to be assuming more and more responsibilities from Air Combat Command and Air Force Space Command as we went forward. So, you know, and we get as we get into late 2011 to 2012, we discover, hey, you know, we win the Creech Award for the most improved aircraft maintenance and logistics readiness. And one of the things that, you know, is that should have been obvious to it, but maybe wasn't until we went into it, is that once you get people focused on it, and once you give them metrics that you know they know you're measuring, and they can measure and they can see it too, and you have transparency on that, things tend to improve. You know, I think it was, may have been General Creech who said, you know, if you measure something, it improves. You have to be careful, because, you know, you might measure the wrong thing and now you're wasting people's energy improving that. But a lot of time it just improves because people are paying attention to it. So by the time we get to 2013, so been active, you know, 3.5 years, we've actually have increased the sorts readiness. So that's a combination of a lot of different data by almost 50% across the command, both ICBMs and the bombers. So, you know, people are focused on their jobs. We're rewarding things like sortie rates, flying hour completion. I mean, I think we first time with the bombers had completed their flying hour program in, you know, maybe 8 or 9 years, was that first full year under Air Force Global Strike Command. Let's see what else we got. So let me unless you have some questions now, I'll go through a couple of topics here real quick, some of which we've already touched on.
Well, because of our time, I'll give you a couple minutes to sort of hit the highlights. And then I don't want to get out of here without bringing Bob the Genie in to see. And you can either, he can either grant you, you can ask hindsight wishes of what you wish you would have had back then, or you can ask prospective wishes, because I think Bob can go backward or forward. But I'll let you finish, take the next couple minutes and sort of wrap up these early years for us and that, you know, what was important and challenging.
I think we already hit on structure and authorities, and we hit on the culture pretty good. Resourcing was the biggest challenge. Okay. And resourcing, not just the people, I think we've talked about the people, but the dollars too. So, you know, you stand up this new command, you expect to get an infusion of money. We sort of got an infusion of money, you know, because of the way the fiscal years flow out, doesn't show up right away. There's some money they can move, but not a lot. So now you're looking at future budgets to make things happen. So what happens? Well, we have the Air Force, we have the DOD efficiency effort happens in 2010. That gets implemented. And now all of a sudden you're being squeezed on the financial resources. And then what happens? The Budget Control Act, 2011. Yep. You know, and Budget Control Act, although it didn't go into effect until January of 13, so it came in with the FY13 budget, it affected all of the planning from then on out. So, you know, so it, then it was just sort of a, you know, the Pentagon is located close to Congress because it's the Pentagon's all about money. Yeah. It's how you get money. And all the battles, you know, all of the frustrations that happen between services are primarily about money. And so within the Air Force, fight was on. You know, we were struggling to get the money that we needed to accomplish a number of different programs, not only to improve and bring up the nuclear enterprise to where we can ensure that it's safe, secure, and effective, but we also knew that we had skipped an entire generation of modernization. And, you know, we had the Reagan era, and then we skipped, you know, we went 20 years and we skipped it because, you know, we were in deterrence 2.0 and we were going to be pals with the Russians. And now we were going, holy crap, all of those weapons are aging out. We have to replace them. And the timeline is getting small. So you've got LRSO, the replacement for the Alcum. You've got ground-based strategic deterrent, GBSD, which is now the Sentinel. You know, that's the replacement for the Minuteman III. You've got
B-21s.
Yeah, LRSB, long-range standoff bomber. Yeah, B-21. I haven't called it LRSB in a long time. So, but all of those things were, well, now we have to start on that. And the biggest thing was trying to lay in the budgets for that, complete the AOAs, complete the analysis of alternatives and the, you know, all, and the entire bureaucratic process there, so we can turn these things into real programs of record. And that was another big challenge early on, was trying to do that from a 3-star billet with a lot of pressure on those funding lines. But, you know, to some extent, Putin's invasion of the Crimea in 2014 gave people pause for thought. And we saw the tide turn on a lot of that.
Yeah. And then the Chinese and the North Koreans and the Russians again. So that world of the 2009 Prague speech turned out to be a mirage. Yeah. And then here we are. Yeah. So as I bring out Bob the Genie and Bob grants you 3 wishes, and you can ask, you know, you can look back and make 3 wishes, or you can look forward. So, or you can do, you know, some of both. So, you know, for your wish, your number one wish, what would that wish be?
That's a good one. You mean we can go back and change something, or
you can
make
go
something
back
happen in the future?
Yeah, you can do either one. You can pick and say, I wish back in 2009 I would have had this, or we would have done this, or you looked forward to the future, either way.
Yeah, I would probably want to look forward to the future and just sort of get a public awakening on the danger that's out there. You know, I find it very troubling, this isolationist tendency that I see this turning our back on the Ukraine. You know, there's this idea that you know, Russia. You know, and I heard this when I was a STRATCOM commander from 3-star generals. Well, Russia's not really a problem. Their demographics are such that they're just going to go away. No, you know, that didn't happen, you know, and we heard the same thing when we went out and we had some very deep concerns about Chinese nuclear weapons and the use of the Chinese tunnels to hide and move, and basically how opaque their program was. It was, you know, we felt back in 2011 and 12 that it was dangerous to assume that we knew all we needed to know about the Chinese nuclear program. And we were assured by all the intelligence professionals that was not a problem. Don't worry about it. There was Dr. Philip Karbler had his class reach out to open source data and put together a pretty good assessment of of Chinese missile program and the use of those tunnels. So really, I mean, the evidence has been out there and it continues to grow, but it's like we still don't want to admit that this is truly a existential problem. Now we can talk about issues with the global war on terror and all the threats from terrorists and, you know, terrorists with nuclear weapons. But at the end of the day, the existential threats are coming from peer and near peer adversaries who have significant nuclear arsenals. And I remember watching Strategic Air Command that movie with Jimmy Stewart and people being more motivated by that. And we just don't have that same respect for the people that do this mission day in and day out. And we don't have the same recognition and understanding of why we need to keep a strong nuclear force to deter adversaries and assure allies, and respect and honor that force. And so anyway, there's my wish.
Okay, well, you get three. So what's your second wish?
I tell you what, if you could just ball them up into that one and make that one happen, I'd be good. You know, and one of the big things that we had to explain to those guys, particularly those young officers that only knew the global war on terror, was they wanted to be in the fight. You know, they didn't feel like they could do that when they were doing their nuclear stuff. I said, you had to remind them, you have to keep that dualism in mind. Yeah, this is the mission that you don't want to have to do. But if you really don't want to have to do this mission, you'd be damn good at being ready to do this mission.
Yeah.
Because if you are the best you can be at that mission, then your adversary is going to be less inclined to take any kind of risk with you or any kind of risk with neighbors who are partners or allies of the United States. Yeah. You know, there's a three-star general that retired here in Shreveport, passed away a few years ago. And when he was a captain, he was an aircraft commander and he met General LeMay in a bar. It was the officers club bar. General LeMay standing there by himself and he's not talking to anybody. This young captain, walked up to General LeMay and said, "Hey, General, how you doing? Blah, blah, blah. He gave him his name." And LeMay looked at him and says, "What's your position on the airplane?" He says, "I'm an aircraft commander." He goes, "What's your circular error probable? What's your average time to target?" and the kid, he didn't know it and he walked away, but he was struck by that moment that what General LeMay cared about was how good he was at his job. He didn't want to sit there and have chit chat with him. He became the vice at the Strategic Air Command and was an 8th Air Force Command. That was General Edgar Harris. So,
LeMay once again having impact on people's lives.
So. Absolutely.
All right. Well, with that excellent story, I guess we'll call it an episode. So, General Kowalski, thanks for joining us on this episode of NucleCast.
Thanks. Good talking to you, Adam. Take care.
And thanks to you, the listeners, for joining us, and we'll see you on the next episode.
This has been a production of the ANWA Deterrence Center, a 501c3 that seeks to educate key decision makers, stakeholders, and the public to ensure a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrent. Our executive producer is Kimberly Charrington, and this episode has been engineered and mixed by David Krumpel. Help us grow our followers by sharing it and follow the show on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Twitter at NucleCast.